Welcome to Baltimore Internet Radio. I'm Dave Custy. Today we will be discussing health care reform, and in particular the Affordable Care Act. And my guest today is Dr. James Burdick. Dr. Burdick is former director of the Office of Special Programs at the Health Resources and Services Administration at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. He is also a professor of transplantation surgery at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine, Division of Transplantation. He is writing a book detailing his doctor's plan for health reform. Welcome, Dr. Burdick.
Thank you, Dave. Pleasure to be here.
Tell us a little bit about yourself to start off.
I'm semi-retired. I'm not seeing patients or doing clinical work anymore, although I still am enjoying doing some scientific and administrative work with the transplant group at Hopkins. I did have a career as an abdominal organ transplant surgeon. That's livers, kidneys, and pancreas transplantation. And also career in what the processes at the national level should be for transplantation. And this is because transplantation is sort of a special area of medicine in which the precious gift of a donated organ from a deceased donor is necessary for many of the transplants. And having this work right has been a big goal of legislation and regulation in the country as part of a public-private partnership with the transplant community. So much of the work I did at the national level in helping make this work as well as we could was actually not as a government person, but as a private member of the medical community. And that's a thread that I think needs to run through our view of healthcare reform. I did also have a stint as a federal employee working in the Department of Health and Human Services on the transplant program as well.
That's great. Well, we have to come back, get you back and do a show on transplantation.
Be glad to do that.
That's great. How did you get interested in healthcare reform?
Part of the sort of national background that I was involved with in transplantation, I suppose, in a general way, was responsible. But healthcare reform has been very much on the radar screen for people in medicine for many years. And actually, I first began to look seriously at what was going on back with the Clinton attempt at healthcare reform. I was certainly part of some of the clinical work being done to advance opportunities for healthcare coverage, the HMOs, and other things that were going on over the last couple of decades of the previous century, and had hopes for the Clinton plan and was really disappointed when it turned out that that wasn't going to really improve coverage for people and decrease costs. And since that time, over the past 10 or 15 years, I guess, I've been thinking about how to really get to the essence of what's needed. And that's sort of what has brought me to this point.
And, of course, your experience with healthcare throughout your career, and I'm sure that has been monumental in what you thought at different times should have been much better, you know, worked out and that kind of stuff, I think, probably.
Absolutely. In fact, one very good example of that, specifically in transplantation, is the difference between different organs that one might transplant. As it happens, for several decades, the country has had a program in place for end-stage renal disease, for dialysis, which is the treatment of a machine cleansing of the blood, or for transplanting a kidney, which, as a clinical transplant surgeon, I think is, and scientific data also agree with me, is really a preferable way when that can be done. Because of my interest in doing that sort of treatment, working with dialysis and transplant patients who had kidney disease, I was fortunate, as were the patients, because the U.S. government has an entitlement program and an end-stage renal disease program, which really allowed me to figure out what a patient needed and do it. And the patient, perhaps with some financial difficulty, but relatively little, was able to go ahead and have that done, regardless of their circumstances. However, when immunosuppression improved and transplantation improved and we began to be able to do liver transplants, which is came along 10 to 15 years later than kidney transplants, we had an absolutely different situation. In principle, it would be the same, but there was no end-stage liver program, and patients often had a very serious issue with how they were going to be able to obtain a liver transplant. The comparison between the economic misery and difficulty of patients with end-stage liver disease facing a possible transplant and the benefits of the entitlement program for kidney disease was a profound example of how I could see that we could do a lot better.
Very good. How did you get interested in writing a book about doctors? It says detailing his doctor's plan for health reform, and I got that off the Sun papers, which sounds a little bit, it's not very detailed in what it says. Tell me about how did you get interested in writing the book, and what do they mean by doctor's plan for health reform? Are you the doctor that's planning it?
Yes, I think I'd be one of them, but I'm really talking about the doctors in the U.S., not just one or two individuals. I spent some time writing and talking to people about my ideas, which I'll mention in a minute, but finally realized that the only way I would have a shot at getting reasonable understanding and interest in what I think is a good approach to these problems was writing a book, and so that's how I got interested in writing a book. The essence of this really relates to the fact that we need a better organizational foundation for how improvements in healthcare can occur and how healthcare in general can be provided. It's obvious, I think, perhaps to all of your listeners, Dave, that today we have really a lot of improvements going on, both because of legislation, the Affordable Care Act that we'll talk a little bit more about, and also American medicine is really beginning almost spontaneously to make improvements, decreasing costs, improving ways to streamline care, to make it better for patients. So we have a whole lot of good things emerging now in healthcare. It's a very optimistic time. But I think there's one fundamental need that hasn't been addressed, and that is an overlying organizational approach. Simply put, I think that we need a national understanding with a board of doctors and nurses, an interprofessional board, openly and transparently looking at healthcare needs, looking at individual items of healthcare, diseases and tests, et cetera, and determining what care is the right care. Too often we provide too much care if a patient has a lot of insurance, or obviously too little care if the patient turns up and doesn't have good insurance, even if the patient does make it to medical attention. So that's a big need, and doctors have an additional need for this, and that is that we're in a situation of information overload. We have so many different organizations providing excellent information and studies about what kinds of tests and treatments are appropriate, when to do them and when not to do them, that an average doctor sitting in his or her office isn't able to digest all of this for each patient all day long in an effective way. We need to have that put together in a national way so that there's an understanding in the medical field about what the right things to do are. There's an understanding on the part of the public about what tests and treatments are appropriate, how frequently mammograms should be provided, and many other such things. And the only way we can really have this happen authoritatively in a way that will work is to have doctors and other medical professionals who are actually treating patients take the leadership role. It's not something that can be legislated or regulated. And with that, we can provide a basis for organizing the American medical effort much more effectively. So that the main point in writing the book is to describe what I've called the doctor's plan, which is essentially a way to provide essential care for every patient, and that means all care necessary for life, limb, and preservation of sanity, and to have this board determine what the right things are so that if a patient turns up and needs care, they get it, no questions asked, just as in Canada or the United Kingdom or most other developed nations. But also, if the patient really shouldn't get the care, and it's going to be not only costly but perhaps dangerous to the patient to have a certain test or treatment done, because it's very clear in the data that that particular test or treatment won't help the patient, the board will have decided that and will help the doctor and the patient understand that as well. The book has several ways to show how this could be made to work. We can't get into the weeds too much here too easily, but it's the sort of thing that could easily be put together, and I've partly come to it because it, in a small way, is based on the model of how we do determine care in the transplant field, which has been going on for the last couple of decades. So I know that doctors can get together and have an open public meeting and make really tough decisions about what's going to happen to medical institutions and to individual practitioners in a very creative and effective way.
Well, that's a very good teaser for the book. I like that. I have two questions from that, and one of them will be answered in detail in the book. It's great that there are other doctors like you that want to pursue this in terms of organizing and getting something from A to Z. You have a lot of people, contacts and such, that you have talked to, and there is like a network of people like that?
This is not something that has a life of its own at present. I have certainly been in touch with a lot of colleagues and friends about this, and have found a great deal of support and enthusiasm for the general ideas. I have to say that there are things that concern my colleagues, such things as who's going to choose the people on the board and what happens if there's a tough decision to be made. And I believe that there are very reassuring and easy answers to many of the concerns that I hear. I go into this more in the book. But the point is that in an open, data-driven process, the right conclusions can be put together, and then if there is more information or something else comes along, a problem with side effects that weren't realized, this would be a very easy, facile way to make the changes. And I think doctors are used to dealing with medicine in this way on their own. I think doctors are increasingly aware that they can't go on each doing it in their own office in parallel all across the country. And more as this general mechanism seeps into consciousness in American medicine, I'm confident that there will be many more who are interested. I should mention that I think one of the principal things that would be important is not to have a few people who are sort of making this as their career. I think that a lot of the actual work needs to be done by people taking some time out from their practice and having that worked out in a reasonable way. Because we're really talking about actual, on-the-ground patient care. We're not talking about how much to pay doctors. Somebody else is going to have to be deciding that besides the doctors. We're not talking about some of the other related healthcare issues regarding organizational structure or companies that are making devices and drugs. That's all going to have to go on in perhaps the way it is now or in some improved way. But we're talking about the basic issue of determining what the quality of care will be for each patient. And I think doctors are going to have an interest in being part of that. Most doctors will need to really mainly be willing to work within the precepts of this authoritative board and the rules and policies that are being made. Relatively few doctors, although many dozens over a long period of time, will actually have to take time out and work on the details.
Well, I think that's a very good idea about taking some time out there, because I know doctors are very busy, and just to be able to concentrate on this. But I'm hoping, too, that this broadcast, which hopefully will go worldwide, might instill some people to really be interested, especially across the U.S. And also, what I would like to do, if you're up to it at a later date, is to come back and we can do a live networking with people who call in from anywhere in the world. And we can discuss this, too, if you're interested in doing something like that.
I think that would be a very constructive thing to do. I certainly would be delighted to be part of it. If there are people out there who are interested in the details of how this might be made to work, I'd be delighted to hear from them. You'll give some contact information at the end of the show. But I just would say that this, I see this as something that is already being hinted at in writings in amongst people who are writing in the journals or who are in charge of the important organizations such as the American Medical Association or the American Board of Internal Medicine and American College of Surgeons. So I believe actually that this is going to grow in awareness about these sorts of principles, along with a lot of the other things that are happening in American medicine wonderfully and positively in the last really few years.
The second point that I find that's crucial that you mentioned, and it was one of your writings in The Sun, too, and it was not more care, better care.
That is a fascinating topic, and I'll sort of provide an introduction to this concern with a little bit of background information. The long and short of it is that overutilization or overuse is definitely an important part of the problem that American medicine has. It is not the practice is not reined in the way it is perhaps in other countries where there are defined budgets for health care. And the problem of overutilization means that it's one of the major reasons we're spending a lot more on healthcare in this country than we do in other countries. That by itself is perhaps not the most important problem, though. The most important problem is that any test or treatment has at least a little bit of a possible risk or downside. And the more we do things that aren't quite the right thing to do and aren't needed, and the patient would be fine without it, and the patient's going to live to be 85 no matter if we don't do that, the more we do those things, and then there are fees and facility charges and everything, and the business goes on, the more we run risks for patients. And this is not theoretical. This is very real. Now, how to make more detailed sense of that, you might say, well, how do we do that? And perhaps you recognize that that's exactly what I'm talking about in the issues that I think the doctor's plan must address. That is, not only do we need to provide the right care for everybody, but we need to not provide care that is not going to help the person, a test or a treatment that's only going to produce some statistical risk and not tend to extend their life. So I think that that really is an essence of how we can save a lot of money. And I guess I should just maybe summarize it by saying that people like to say we can't have quality care for everybody and save money. And I am always anxious to point out that that's absolutely wrong. We can have quality care for everybody and save money. And the reason we can save money is that, in general, quality does save money. One of the best examples of that is in overutilization, where the patient really shouldn't get the test or treatment, and it costs more, and everybody saves if the patient doesn't get it. But we don't have a mechanism, either through the government or certainly by private insurance right now, to deal with that, and that's why we need the doctor's plan.
Very good. Is there any other bullet points you want to talk about regarding your book? Where we
I
just
would,
tell them to wait till it comes out. I'll let you know where you can buy it.
You've alluded to a couple of other things about how this might work. I think I have called it the doctor's plan because I think doctors have to be involved in this. And I think that's a novel idea. It's, in the past, there's been sort of some distrust at the general policy level of doctors, although one of the things that doctors do have is in an individual basis. They have the trust of their patients, and I think when doctors begin to really take this sort of leadership responsibility and help with the public approach to it, patients will listen, and I think that's a very important point to make. So I think that this is doable. And the reason I think that it can save money is complex. There are many items. It might be worth pointing out that the IOM recently said that we could save $700 billion.
Just for everybody's aggrandizement, what is the IOM?
Sorry, the Institute of Medicine recently, which is a national, it's part of the National Academy of Sciences. It's a national medical study institute that's very authoritative. They said about $700 billion possible a year of savings. And to put this into perspective for people, we'll probably spend about $2.7 trillion in U.S. healthcare this year. It's true that the rate of increase in costs has been going down a little, but we haven't really started to get those costs down yet. And so the amounts being spent are really absolutely amazing. And $700 billion, however, would be a major help. My approach to this involves the concept that there would be some sort of single funding, either, quote, single payer through the government or through insurance plans that are put into place in a very much different way than present-day health insurance business is run. But at any rate, we could decrease costs through decreased administration, through the cost of uncompensated care when patients don't get good care and then they come in sick and get expensive care, and through many other ways. And it's easy to add up many hundreds of billions of dollars that we could save. And I'm talking about covering everybody with quality care and save that money. And so we actually can be then figuring that there's money that's being spent now on healthcare that could go for other things in the country. I think that's one of the most important concepts that has not really come across very well as yet.
That's, I think that is important, too, in some of your writings in The Sun. When you talk about, like we just said, not more care but better care, and to streamline, because you mentioned in one of them that about these companies that offer scans that you really don't need, and that could be costly health wise down the road. I can remember, and this was about 10 years ago, where I read that there. Coming up with a scan that's purely preventative. It's a whole scan for your body, and they can see if you are prone to different types of cancer. And of course, it's not covered by health insurance, but you can tell if something's going to happen. And you touch on that in one of your articles in the Sun papers, and I thought, there is a lot of that going on. And it's even, I just spent 10 years living in Northern Ireland, and they were, every so often a company would come and say, we're deducting our $500 fee, £500 fee over there for this, and you can come and get one free, and you can see what kind of things that might happen to you, And then think that, it's kind of a fear-mongering thing, don't you think?
Yeah, I agree 100%, and I think the short answer here is over and over, I think, we need to come back to what's quality of care? What's the best quality of care? And it, in the United States, there tends to be a sense of more is better. In more, taking it sort of more in more general terms from what you're describing for a moment, members of Congress like to say that they want, if they're so inclined, they like to say they'd like everybody to have the kind of care that, that they have coverage for. But they are overlooking the fact that those, what some people call Cadillac healthcare plans, are really not ideal. They probably are too likely to encourage the member of Congress to get a fancy scan they don't really need or to get a treatment that they don't really need. And so, again, we're back to needing a way to define what will be the right thing. I think that sometimes if there are people with certain medical issues, a scan, even if they're doing well at the time, is very important. So it's not that we shouldn't be not doing appropriate tests, but it's very commonly put in place in an advertising way, in the way you're describing, in settings in which somebody's just fine and the institution is hoping that they're going to come up with something they can convince the potential patient to pay money for that really would represent, in my view, usually overutilization, and therefore running a risk for the patient without helping them. And I think a more measured approach to what health care we get and what health care we don't get is really part of this approach of quality of care for the patients. You know, it goes to drugs as well. The biggest problem with pharmaceutical expenses in the country is really the cost per pill. It's not that we take that much more medicine, but I think we could improve in terms of the degree to which right now there's advertising to take this or that or the other pill, and it's really not something that's a medically valuable thing for the patient. And I always like the quote from Sir William Osler, who was a famous early physician at Hopkins, who said, it is the duty of the doctor to convince the public not to take medicine.
Okay. On that note, let's discuss some of the parts of the Affordable Care Act that's now in effect. There's a lot of people out there that think that all of it's happening right now, and some think it's nothing's happening right now. So if you can just kind of a bullet point some of the things that are in effect, and then after that, what will go in effect January 1st.
Sure. I'll bring up a few high points. I'm not going to go exhaustively through it. I have spent some time in the Act, and it's there are a lot of words. My download of the entire bill runs to a little over 2,000 pages, so you may or may not want to bother with all that.
You haven't read every word yet?
I have skimmed through it, but not very really carefully. I think that it's like any other huge legislation. I might start by saying that there are some issues that I think can be fixed, because no law with 2,000 pages is going to not have stuff that needs additional laws to deal with unforeseen problems. And that might be reassuring to certain small businesses who may be having some trouble now and so forth. I view this as somewhat a work in progress, as any big legislative act is. But remember that this is a huge success for the country. It's the second time in 100 years that we have really done something important to improve health care for the citizens of America, the first being the Medicare Act in 65. And so it is a wonderful new entity in itself, and it provides wonderful new hope for where things can go. Let me say a few things that it's done already. It's already reducing the number of Americans without coverage, particularly so far, extension of family coverage to dependents up to age 26. Also, it's already got improved coverage for children. It's rapidly improving the availability of coverage through Medicaid in states that are going along with it and states that aren't going along with it. At present, I predict, will gradually fall into line as soon as the political resistance can recede. It strengthens pharmaceutical coverage. The recent Medicare Part D, which is the part that pays for pills, has problems. The big one is this donut hole where you get, after you've spent a certain amount of money, then you don't get any more money to help reimburse your costs for an increased amount of spending until you get to a really high budget for medicines. That donut hole is going to gradually recede, and that has started. One thing that's available for people who are severely disadvantaged is the Community Health Center program. It's administered through HRSA. It's a very important part of the safety net that isn't always understood by people, and that's strengthened in the Affordable Care Act. So those are all things that are really underway. And, of course, 2014 is the deadline for establishing the insurance exchanges. It's going to be not possible for insurance to rule out coverage of somebody with pre-existing conditions. It's going to have other benefits that are going to gradually roll out until I think something like 2019. But I think the big push now is to have insurance companies and states put together the necessary programs to implement the provisions of the law, and that is in underway now. But there are a lot of things that are going to take time, and exactly how quickly this will go is anybody's guess. But the major changes for the health insurance should be in place soon after 2014, if not right then. I would point out that although this is a major step forward, it is not the health care reform that the country wants or that I envision. It's not what I'm talking about in my book, although in my book I show how this is such a contribution to moving things forward. I think the problems with it is that when we rely on Medicaid, that's a state political football. That's reliance on that in the law is a problem. The mandates are necessary given the present structure, but that's a flawed idea. We still have many millions of Americans who won't be covered by the provisions in the law, and there may be increase of costs and insurance premiums for some groups. The small businesses in certain settings may have difficulties with continuing to fund employer insurance or how to deal with that if they're not going to. I think there are many ways that we could move forward and much more fundamentally towards a single-payer system down the road. That's going to be more and more clear with time.
But when you talk about, like you just said, smaller businesses might have some problems paying for it. Isn't that a very small... Someone desperately needs you. Okay, we're back. No problem. Isn't that a very small percentage, though, that it would affect...
It certainly, there are a couple of answers to that. It certainly is a small percentage of total businesses, and even not all small businesses. And, I'm not an expert in this, but small businesses are also kind of a phrase that people use that doesn't really encompass what's going on. Small businesses open and close frequently. A lot is going on with a small business, and what happens to a small business is subject to many influences that are not relevant to the healthcare issues, and who is going to be having more trouble with their small business is something that I think is very important to deal with. It's not a huge part of the nation's economy, but it's really one of the things that I'm sympathetic with in a way that I think it's a defect in the act that needs to be remedied. And as I said, it's a huge law, and there are defects that will need attention. And I will bet that as soon as these things become clear enough so that the Congress can get a grasp of it, that there'll be a way to patch that so that the law doesn't cause this trouble for these isolated, difficult-to-define situations.
Well, my point in saying it was a small percentage is basically a paradigm for the whole act, in that there's more pros than cons. And we're actually doing something that is positive. Like you say, it would be terrific to go to the single payer, but what I understand is that the insurance companies have like 9 lobbyists to every congressperson, and so it kind of changed things there. Is that correct, or am I not?
You're right that the business interests in American healthcare have the Congress's attention, and all the numbers, that's one good statistic. There are several statistics of numbers of people and dollars of money that show you very clearly that that's the case. But remember, this healthcare law got passed, and on the one hand, it's going to really change how insurance does business in a good way. It's going to decrease insurance costs. It's going to stop, to a large degree, this business of canceling a plan. It's called rescission. It's going to it's going to get rid of refusing to cover somebody because of pre-existing conditions and other ways that it will control the insurance business. So I think that it got passed in spite of the insurance companies preferring not to have any of that happen. How much the insurance companies will be able to resist the increasing tide of improvements that is occurring as a result of the law and as a result of the healthcare in general in the country really being worked on by American medicine, not all just because of the law, I think is a question down the road. My book talks about the issue of what I would like to call supplemental care. And this is, just for a minute, I'll mention, this is something that's a problem or an issue in every country, a fact in every country. Most of the developed countries, Canada, the UK, all the European countries have some sort of state-run healthcare system. There are quite a few differences, but the point is they have a state-run system. That's the public support for medicine. But all of those countries also have private healthcare being bought and used. If you look at the list of the different countries, Canada is third in the list. Now, the U.S. is about 50-50, private and public, and no other country approaches that, of course. But down a little bit lower, there's a lot of private health care being paid for in Canada, and I don't think people usually understand that. And I think that the way that's important for our thinking about the country in general is that can compete, for instance, in waiting times with people who are getting the public care. And I think we need to deal with that right up front. But there's no way that we're going to no longer have any health insurance in the country. Just as in every other country, there will be some private health insurance. And I think we need to incorporate that in our understanding of how the system will work in a way that will allow us to control any tendency for this private care, for maybe things that aren't covered by essential care, or for fancier offices with goldfish bowls and plush carpets and so forth. This supplemental care will work and will be fine, and people can pay for it out of pocket or with insurance, as long as it doesn't interfere with care of patients who are just on the public system and getting essential care, and as long as it doesn't interfere by causing any cost to the taxpayer. So I think, actually, that the insurance companies will gradually begin to see that modification and compromise in that direction is going to be where it'll go, and it'll decrease the massive profits that healthcare insurance industry gets now. But I think that that's the handwriting is on the wall there sooner or later. I'm just telling you how I view that this might happen.
I have a good friend who sells health insurance, and he tells me that on July 9th there is some kind of, for lack of a better word, big meeting or something, some kind of decision that they're going to tell all the health insurance agents about in terms of the Affordable Care Act. So I'm going to have him on right after that so he can explain, you know, their side and what they're going to do, because he tells me right now, if he came on right now, it would be completely different from when it would be on July the 9th. Now, it's interesting, too, when you talk about other countries, because I just spent 10 years living in Northern Ireland, and they have, they're part of the UK, so their system is socialized medicine as opposed to ours, which is socialized health insurance. Is that correct?
Most countries have what you would call socialized medicine by sort of a standard definition in this country today. They do vary considerably. Some Germany, for instance, has health insurance, but it's health insurance that's controlled and run in a very different way.
So getting back to our, I'm skipping ahead again in our agenda there, but if there are a bunch of myths out there. People have ideas that really aren't what the Affordable Care Act is about. Can you discuss some of those?
Sure. People who are either against the Affordable Care Act or have other political agendas have raised countless things. We can start with some of the things you hear the most. Of course, the idea of death squads or death panels. The issue of end-of-life care is something that is now really beginning to be dealt with better by medicine in this country, but has not been handled well. And because we have this sort of more is better, Cadillac plan if possible kind of mentality, we tend to not recognize that a thoughtful relationship between the patient care team, doctor and others, often a nurse can be very important in this, for instance, who's known the patient for a while, and the patient about dealing with failing health or advancing cancer or lung disease or other such issues that will probably cause the patient to die down the road, dealing with that in a way that will make it easiest for the patient to go through that and easiest for the patient's family is very important. So I think originally the law would have helped practitioners do that and get paid for it, whereas it's under the heading right now, because this got taken out of the law, of something that the practitioner will do because it's the right thing to do, but it's against the disincentive that it's not part of what is typically included in the package that they're being paid to do. At any rate, the idea is that we do need to improve how we make a patient comfortable and have a humane time during a patient's death. And we have not done a good enough job in the country, and it would be a terrible, just a tragedy, if this silliness, politically dominated silliness, were to interfere with an improved approach to quality of death. In most cases, patients will be able to see the same doctor. That's another sort of threat that's out there. Or patients or people, the public is being told by some people that the government or the insurance companies are going to be deciding on the care they get. Well, you know, right now we do have a fair amount of government and insurance company involvement in what care people get. certainly doctors are continually struggling with insurance companies about something a patient really needs to have done, a test or a treatment. The insurance company puts blocks in the way to having that happen. So it's not that that's not happening now, but the Affordable Care Act really does a lot towards improving the chances that medical input will be the important deciding factor, and it encourages doctors and the medical field in general to figure out what the right thing to do is and do it in many ways. So it's far from taking over deciding care by the government.
Okay, any other myths you want to talk about?
The biggest problem we have in this country is the fairly unthinking concept that the business approach is the way to determine medical care. So when you buy insurance, you can choose a premium. If you have a possible test or treatment the doctor's proposing, you may decide on the basis of copay, or it may be that the premium you are paying means that you're going to have to pay for the whole thing because it's a low-value service, and you have that economic decision to make. And the point about all of that is that when you're talking about health care, having the patient to determine what care they're going to get based on economic factors is clearly incorrect. It sometimes will cause a patient who's got good insurance and wants to have something done, and the insurance will pay for it, to get something done they shouldn't get done. Doctors shouldn't go ahead with that, but sometimes it's a gray area, and that is definitely a problem in the country. But too often, also, patients can't afford a high premium, and they end up with illness that they can't get taken care of effectively because it's going to cost too much out of their own pocket when they do get sick. And so the whole idea that we should have market-based insurance, that patients should have a chance to determine the value of the plan that they're going to have and choose an amount of money that they want to put into it, really, in the first place, makes no sense. In the second place, there are tremendous amount of information available that shows that that's just not, that economic theory is not the way to go about things in medicine. And in fact, markets in medicine don't work in general, and that's no big mystery. If you have a place that increases the number of hospitals, you would think that the cost of care in each of those hospitals would go down and the health of the population would go up. In fact, that doesn't happen. Increasing the number of hospitals doesn't increase the patient's care within the range of the things that you see in the U.S., And in fact, hospitals often end up charging as much or more, even though there's more, what you would think, more competition. So the general way of looking at it through market principles is wrong. And part of the impetus, as I began to realize that, for my determining a new plan, which is this novel doctor's plan, to have an authoritative national panel determine what the correct care is going to be, is based on the idea that, well, if you can't use that insurance market model, and I'm saying you can't have the government make these specific patient care decisions for several obvious reasons, I don't think we need to go into them, then we need another way, and my proposal is the doctor's plan.
I think that's a great proposal, and like we had said earlier, I would like to be able to have a small part in that in terms of networking. Doctors like doctors like you are interested in putting the time together and talking about this and how to resolve this in the best way possible. Because what you come up with is a very sensible thing. I mean, you hear all sorts. Of course, what you hear in the media are usually one extreme or the other because they have to sell it. But you know, this is such a measured, good approach to this, and it makes sense. I mean, there are going to be problems, and there's a lot of gray matter in there, but it really is needing something. I mentioned before, and I was living in Europe, I wasn't a I was a permanent resident in the United Kingdom. Well, people dispute that because it was Northern Ireland, but it was under the auspices of the United Kingdom. But I felt that no matter if something happened to me catastrophic, I would be covered, and I was. You know, you wouldn't get stories about you had something wrong with you. Like there's a story that a friend of mine who was dehydrated and an ambulance came because he thought he had a heart attack and stuff like that, and he had to pay cash out of that. You know, he had to pay because of that. And I just feel that something like this will alleviate that fear. You know, right now I don't have health insurance, and that's terrible. I know I'm one of the 44 million, and I hope that by the time that this is implemented in terms of whether mid 2014 or whatever, I'll be able to get it because it's, you know, I hear people what they're paying and what they're getting, and the deductibles are outlandish, and I mean, it's like something has to be that's measured in a great approach. I mean, there are problems in the UK in terms of in their system because the preventative medicine is not really all that terrific. You get 8 minutes for a physical. It took me almost 4 years to get a colonoscopy. You know, the preventative stuff, they still need to work on it. There's stories about people who have cancer and that have to wait in line to be administered and things like that. And so there's no real perfect system, but the way that we've had the system now in terms of that the poorest don't get anything, and people can go bankrupt with just the, you know, the smallest treatment, really. That
Absolutely.
Has to be changed.
Yeah, you know, that you raise an important issue with the UK. The UK does have some problems with its health care. It does require some small copays, but there's so much that it makes more sense about how they deal with things there. And actually, I have more experience. I know some Canadians and have talked with very Canadian doctors. I've talked with doctors who were practicing in the U.S. and went to Canada to practice. The story is good no matter how you spin it, and all of the lies that are told in this country about that are just wrong. Now, the Canada has some problems. It's had worse problems with its system along the way that it's corrected partly. But that if somebody gets sick, this is a quote from two Canadians, more or less said the same thing, but this is all how they feel. You get taken care of and you don't get sent a big bill. And the waiting times, they monitor them. They're trying to improve them. The costs are excessive in some ways, but they're trying to deal with them. But there isn't anybody in Canada who would say, you know, this just isn't working. In fact, people who are older and more likely to have health problems who may be visiting in this country in the wintertime, let's say, if you talk to them, they will tell you to a person, I've never heard any Canadian say anything different, if they got sick, and they could possibly do it, they would get on the next plane out of the States and go to Canada. So that's what we need here, and we can even improve on it. We can start from scratch. We can deal with the issues of waiting time and other things better. And I think it is common sense. It's just a matter of sort of rethinking how we view how medicine needs to be done and who decides how it's going to work, without taking it away from the provenance of the individual doctor talking with the individual patient about the options that are best for that patient.
That's what it really comes down to, is that,
exactly.
That one-on-one and to get the best care, not the most care, like you say. In terms of, and this is kind of a big, broad question, but how do you see it's going to look like at December 31st, 2014?
There will be insurance exchanges in some states, but not all states. And I don't know, it might be 50-50, but I'm not really following this acutely enough to be too confident of it. There will be probably about 50% of the states who have accepted either the straightforward federal plan or negotiated a deal with HHS for the Department of Health and Human Services for a plan for the additional coverage for the for extending Medicaid coverage to more people in their state. Healthy 20-somethings who are going to just say, well, they're going to pay the mandate and not put the money into health care, will be an increasing volume, I think, initially. My sense is that that's going to become difficult because the idea is, well, since at that point a health care insurance company has to insure you even if there's a pre-existing condition, somebody can just pay the mandate and then get their health insurance if they get sick, may not work quite as easily, and people may get may find that they're getting into trouble doing that. But that's going to be an important part of the issue, and it's one of the reasons the mandate is not a perfect thing, and it's one of the reasons that going about this in a more clean, pure, single-payer approach is a very important thing to keep in mind.
I didn't mean to put you on the spot there. I just wanted to conjecture about what you would think at the end of the year would be. And that brings it to my next question about the single payer. Do you really think that that will happen?
Yes, I do. In fact, I don't have any good intellectual backup for this, but I have an intuition about the Affordable Care Act. And that intuition is based on the fact that I think for the first time, a doctor for every family is a realistic dream for Americans. And I think they're getting that picture. And I don't think it can be done with quality for everybody and save money unless we do eventually go to single payer. There are some important advocates out there, but I don't think people have thought enough about how the single-payer process would work in two ways. Number one is determining how the care is going to be given, just like in England, but that's not quite perfect. And in the second way, determining how we're going to deal with the funding for it. And so I think that that's why I felt that we need to go beyond a general philosophy of single payer and really think about the details of how to make this work. And that's part of really the impetus for my book about healthcare reform.
Well, that's a good segue, because here's the part about promoting your book. Tell us about the logistics of it.
Where I am right now is I've written a very big book that had 600 endnotes and many words that probably put me to sleep reading them as well as would anyone else. So that's been clearly not going to be something that I can continue with. So I've taken everything that's in the book that's important and removed everything that's not important, which meant cutting it about in half. And I've taken out most of the notes and other things that would really confuse people, and we now have a much more reasonable approach to making the points that I've been making in this hour with you today, and I'm getting editing done, and I'm hoping to get a more firm commitment from a publisher before too long, but I don't have anything else more specific to announce at this point.
Well, that's great. I'm looking forward to it, and I hope that you come back, because we've only just touched the tip, I think, in this hour, and as it progresses toward January 1st and what's happening now, I think that a lot more discussion should happen here, and I really appreciate you taking the time to be on Baltimore Internet Radio. And if you would like, do you want to give your email address and people can contact you, especially those doctors that might be interested too?
Yes, you can find it on the Hopkins website. It's JBURDIC, and then an Arabic one. So it's JBURDIC 1, but it's JBURDIC without a K. JBURDIC 1 at JHMI.edu.
Very good. We've been talking to Dr. James Burdick, who is writing a book detailing a doctor's plan for health reform, and we hope he comes back soon. And Thank you for taking the time again, Doctor.
It's been a real pleasure, David, and I do hope we'll have a chance to get together again about it.
I sure hope we do, too. Thank you.